Do you know when you're in the pub and an old football match comes on, a rocket of a shot hits the bar and bounces out? And then somebody says, do you ever wonder what would have happened if that had gone in? Imagine if we'd scored that. What if we'd won that game?
Then everyone has an opinion. Well, the manager would probably have kept his job. We could have gone in to win the league that year. Ah, we still would have messed it up. We were shite anyway. Such fine margins that could have potentially massive consequences.
In this series, we look at some of the biggest what-ifs in football history. What happened? What could easily have played out very differently? And what we think might have happened instead? This is Outside the Box.
The 1988 UEFA European Championship Final.
And here's Robins. And did it get the deflection? Was it Robins or Pierce?
Attention. Attention, Kostadinov.
What?
Yes. No. No, the linesman says no. The linesman says no.
I think they should really stop flogging a dead horse, basically. It's over. It's finished.
This week, what if Gazza hadn't busted his knee in the 1991 FA Cup final? Hello and welcome again to another episode of Outside the Box. My name is Dave Fleming, here as always, and joining me as always is Mr. Gerard O'Shea. Gerard, hello.
Hello, Dave. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Pleasure to chat to you as always.
And you chatting down the line here again for another episode, and a good one this week. Something that happened almost exactly 30 years ago to the day as we speak.
In the 1990-91 season, Paul Gascoigne was the undisputed star attraction of English football. His performances for his country at Italian 90 had drawn rave reviews from pundits around the world and seen him named in the team of the tournament. His childlike enthusiasm was infectious, and his tears during the semi-final in Turin won the hearts of a nation.
For club and country, he was the jewel in the crown, the most naturally talented English footballer in a generation and destined for greatness. He was also the clown prince of football, a legendary prankster who donned a pair of fake plastic breasts on England's return from the World Cup. If he had gone to the tournament as Paul Gascoigne, promising young footballer, he returned as Gazza, a national superstar, subject to perhaps the greatest degree of media scrutiny and intrusion since George Best in his pomp.
On the field, the 1990-91 season continued the pattern of Italian 90 with Gazza at the heart of a team not quite up there with the best, but at times he single-handedly leading them through the competitions. He'd been instrumental in getting Spurs to the FA Cup final with a series of match-winning performances and a famous semi-final free kick against Arsenal at Wembley. Serie A, the best league in the world by a mile at the time, naturally came calling. Spurs were desperate for money and agreed to sell him to Lazio for over £8 million. His last game for Spurs would be at Wembley again in the FA Cup final against Nottingham Forest.
Overexcited by the occasion, he lunges into a reckless tackle on Gary Charles, wrecks his knee, and is eventually carried off on a stretcher. His move to Lazio gets delayed. He arguably never recovers his form again, and despite playing for some huge clubs, his career never really hits the heights it might have, and he never plays at a World Cup again. But how different might things have been? What if Gazza hadn't injured his knee in May 1991.
Joining us to discuss this, what might have been, is Mr. Tom Moran. He's an actor, a writer, a comedian. He's also a kind of a semi-professional podcaster. He's hosted Personality Bingo for over 130 episodes. As an actor, you might have seen him in all the major venues across the city, most recently in Copperface Jacks the Musical at the Olympia. And he's the host of RTE TV series Squad Goals. But more importantly, and definitely Ger would agree with this, he's Tottenham till he dies. Hello, Mr. Tom Moran. How are you?
Well, lads, thanks for having me.
A pleasure to have you here. Listen, it's not very often. I think, Ger, I'm in the minority here. I'm talking to two Spurs fans.
Doesn't happen very often.
It doesn't, no. And, you know, it's funny because I say this to my friends who do support, like, the mainstream teams, you know, your Liverpool's, United's, whatever it is, like, I think it's a weird source of, like, self-esteem for me as a Spurs fan, because whatever about now, they've had, like, the Pochettino, you know, relative success, you know, or, like, certainly the weird thing being a Spurs fan now is whatever, like, I know it'll always be thrown at you. You've never won nothing, but, you know, we're in the mainstream media in this way. You never used to, like, there were never there was nothing about Spurs in the mid-2000s, you know what I mean? Like, they were an irrelevance, really. They were a joke club. You could argue they still are for all the kind of calamity going on around it, but they're so central to, like, the kind of football narrative, whether it's the Champions League a couple of years ago or Harry Kane now, Jose, like the Amazon documentary. It's a kind of, it's a weird time to be a Spurs fan, but it's never a boring time to be a Spurs fan.
I'm going to take you back even further. If the 2000 Spurs were a bit of a non-entity, thank God you weren't around in the 90s, because the 90s was a grim enough time where you looked over your shoulder for 40 points every season, because relegation was a genuine threat. And we played dreadful football, had dreadful managers. Like, I remember we finished 7th one year and nearly getting a nosebleed, because this was not the kind of thing that happened to Spurs. So certainly, like, growing up at that time, there was a certain badge of honour, because you certainly weren't a Glory supporter. Like, you couldn't possibly be accused of being a Glory supporter. So yeah, it's a badge of honor, but it's also a bit of a, like, constant source of pain in your life, because it's the hope that kills you. And we're just a classic club for that.
Yeah.
Right, lads, before you get into who's had more misery as a Spurs fan, I know I'm as a United fan, you probably don't want to hear this from me, but we'll start talking about the issue at hand here. Now, Tom, I'm going to turn to you first. Now, I know being a mere sapling of a young man in the YouTube generation with a very short attention span, a man who was not alive when the event that we're talking about here occurred. A Spurs fan, do you have any opinions, or have you thought about how good was Paul Gascoigne, is basically what I'm getting at. How good do you think Paul Gascoigne was?
The thing is, and I don't like my own answer, but Paul Gascoigne was an idea as a young Spurs fan rather than a player in lots of ways. And in kind of getting ready for the chat, you know, I went back and I asked my dad and I asked my uncles, because the Spurs connection for me is a family connection. And, like, the weird thing is, the whole, for all the brilliant moments that he gave Spurs fans, and I think the one that is most, you know, iconic in my mind, and purely based off, as you said, like, literally YouTube compilation clips, but is the Arsenal free kick in the semi-final. But it's all the other stuff that he's remembered for, which is kind of the tragedy of it, but also, like, I think what makes him such a compelling character.
Is Gascoigne going to have a crack? He is, you know. Oh, I say! Brilliant! That is schoolboy's own stuff. Oh, I bet even he can't believe it. Is there anything left from this man to surprise us? That was one of the finest free kicks.
I think you had this idea that, yes, he was incredible, but that he was one of these guys that never fulfilled his potential. And in just getting ready to chat to you and going back into those archives, like, I did see just how incredible he was. I mean, and, like, the one thing that stood out for me more than anything was the sort of, like, improvisational nature of the way that guy played football, and, like, the football intelligence of him, and the way, like, you were just watching a fella, you know, seeing the game at a different pace to everyone else. He was two steps ahead. Like, so he was absolutely incredible. And yet the feeling for me, looking back on Gazza now, was sadly that he's a bit of a joke.
It is still hard to get past that notion, but the more research we did on this, the more, and particularly myself, I'll get into way more detail on this in a bit, but I was very much kind of like, I'm always skeptical of overhyped English players. I'm always thinking the English media builds them up, and I was thinking, the tears at Italia 90 made him super famous. But I went back and I looked, God, for a couple of years, I do think he was genuinely a really remarkable player. But anyway, I'm not going to get ahead of myself here. Jer, when we were talking about this in advance, it turns out that you've actually had a fully fledged theory on exactly what we're talking about here, probably mulling around in your head for a very, very long time. So what I might do is, Tom, myself and yourself might just sit back for a couple of minutes.
It's sometimes easy to forget how astonishingly good he was. And, like, just like Alex Ferguson, people like him called him the best player of his era. Just to keep on a United theme, Brian Robson said he was the best player he played with. Paul Ince said the same. He was a phenomenally talented footballer who could do everything. He had every attribute you could possibly want. He was two-footed, he could tackle, he could dribble, he scored goals, he could head the ball. And his improvisational skills, as you said as well, Tom. And in that period, he had a couple of years at Newcastle. He had a couple of years at Spurs where he was brilliant. Spurs got as high as third in the league the second season he was there. He goes to the World Cup. He makes the team in the tournament. Like, so he was up there playing with the Maradonas and the world at this stage. He comes back from that with all of the media attention on him and actually continues it into the next season. Spurs are third at the turn of the year. They fall away, but he single-handedly gets them to the cup final. And then he does himself in, and he goes off the rails in that period. I think if Gazza stays fit, football was always the anchor in his life. There's lots of people for whom all of those other things that we associate with him later, whether it's, you know, the mental health issues or the substance abuse. And it's not to say that those things would never have been a thing in his life, but he talks himself about how when he had football, you know, he had issues with like tremors and being strange associations with death as a child. And he says himself, when I played football, I didn't have those things. And I think football for him was the thing that kept a lot of those at arm's length. And I think had he gone to Italy in the full of his health as one of, if not the best player in the world in the summer of 91, I don't see any reason why he wouldn't have picked up where he left off when he'd made the step from Newcastle to Spurs, from Spurs to England. He wouldn't have continued to do that in Serie A and been one of the star players in that league. A title is not outside the bounds of possibility. I know there were good teams in Italy at the time, but Lazio were an improving team. You get one of the best players in the world into the heart of that team. It's entirely possible that Lazio could have won a Scudetto in the first two or three years that Gazza's there. Looking at the Italian teams and how they do in Europe, invariably the team that qualifies for the Champions League out of Italy gets to the final or wins it. So it's not outside the bounds of possibility. Lazio win a Champions League with Gazza there. If he stays fit in that entire period, he's probably England captain. Graham Taylor may not be the right man to get something out of him at that, but you know, a Gazza at the heart of an England team, they're only one result away from getting to USA 94 anyway. You add the best player in the world into the middle of that, it's entirely possible England qualify for that World Cup, which is a World Cup that I think the likes of England and France, who don't qualify, as well as all the teams who do, probably look at it as an opportunity lost, because it was quite an even World Cup that was there to be won. And then what happens is a load of players start coming to the Premier League around that 94-95 period. That's when we see the Bergkamps, the Klinsmans, the likes of Platt coming home. So I think it's probable that a Gazza, who may have gone and won all these things, including potential World Player of the Year awards and all that kind of stuff, is a prime target to be brought to England, probably to Manchester United, because we know what Ferguson thought about him. Gazza comes into the heart of the Manchester United midfield, where he remains for the second half of the 90s, and sees out his career with that potential glorious career, probably still over by the time his early 30s for other reasons. But I think we're looking back on it, the 90s as a decade of triumph and success for him personally and at club level for various clubs. And that's what we remember him for rather than the joke that we kind of associate him as now.
It's you're putting a lot on this one moment, this one injury, And you think, Jared, that it's that big a deal?
I do, because I think, and again, I don't want this to just be my opinion for an hour or whatever, but I do think what gets in the way of him fulfilling his potential is the other stuff that we now associate him with. And I think there's a chunk, you know, there was none of that really had manifested itself as a problem. You know, his issues in his early 20s, because he's 20, this incident happens a couple of weeks before his 24th birthday, I think. So, you know, he's a young man, but he's had 6 or 7 years in and around the top level of English football. And I think, as I said, as long as football is there, everything else sort of, you know, it would come crashing in at another point, but potentially when he retires and comes thundering in then. But he gets this year at the wrong time where he can't play football. He can't go to the training ground and have the banter and the sort of other messing that he was associated with. And he's grown up in a footballing culture where the way to kill boredom was to go drinking. And I think that year outside of football, that stuff gets in. And he never gets fit again after it. I mean, he doesn't go to Italy fit and in the right mental state that I think he would have the year before. I just think it's effectively results in a year out of the game that is not just a year out of football. It's a year where he can't live his life because his life is football.
Big statement, Jer. There's a few things you've said in there. One, Gazza, one of the best players in the world, or possibly even the best player in the world in 1991. I'm not sure I'd even go as far as I think he's still. He's had a good tournament Italia 90, an excellent tournament at Italia 90, and he's in the running for the Ballon d'Or. I think he comes fourth that year. Lohar Mateus wins it, but he never gets near it again, even in 91, where he has the season. We know he's you said Spurs were third at the turn of the year, but they ended up finishing 10th that season. And he doesn't get anywhere near the Ballon d'Or running ever again. I'll quickly say that I don't think Lazio win a title in those years that he's there. I think even if he goes at his absolute best and plays at his absolute best, which I don't even know if that definitely would happen. But that Milan team that were there under Capello at the time, I mean, they went through, was it the 92 season, completely undefeated. They won a couple more league titles after that. Then Juventus comes steaming on afterwards. The closest that Lazio get to the league title is in the 95 season, I think, which is Gascoigne's last season in Italy, where they finished second, but they finished 10 points behind Juve, and they only finished 10 points behind Juve because they win their last five games in a row when Juve already have the title won and Juve lose two of their last five games. So it could have been an even bigger gap. If they'd won the league, yeah, I absolutely think if they'd been good enough to win Serie A, they probably would have gone on and won a European Cup or two. You've said yourself, like, Milan were in the final nearly every year. Sampdoria got to a final, only lost to Barcelona. Juventus get to the final the year after they win the league. So, yeah, the standard of Italy is so, so high. But I kind of want to come back to first principles here. You've said that football is the anchor for his life. And he said himself loads of times that when he's on the pitch, everything else goes away. But when he's not on the pitch, the pressure of football and the hype of football is so much for him. I'm not going to be a pop psychologist here and kind of talk about all the issues that he had as a young man. But he couldn't sleep. He had insomnia the nights before matches, even the night before the final itself. He was hopping off the fucking walls. Like, literally, he said he was 2 foot tackling the lamps in the bedroom the night before the final. The doctor had to give him Valium, which I still don't think fully calmed him down. Then the day of the game, he's going mental in the tunnel. He's leathering balls off the tunnel. He nearly takes one of the Forest defenders' heads off. He runs out. He kung fu kicks Gary Parker in the chest. Then the tackle that actually does his knee in is because he's so wound up. But it's not the only time it happens. There's talk that before the Arsenal game, he was similarly wound up. Before the West Germany game in 1990, he was absolutely off the fucking walls, wound up with nerves and nervous energy. And like, even just Gary Lineker, you know, the famous clip when Gazzo does burst into tears, Lineker knows him well, he knows him from Spurs, and he turns to the bench and he points to his eye and he says, you know, keep an eye on him. He's not sure if he's going to be right. I do think that this injury cuts an excellent player in his prime, and he's never the same player again afterwards. But because of all of these issues, like he injures him, he exacerbates the injury on the piss in a nightclub in Newcastle, where he lands on his knee and keeps himself out for another couple of months. When he's in Rome, he gets injured quite a bit. One of them, another reckless tackle in training on his own teammate, Alessandro Nesta, which puts him out for another year. He only makes 40-odd appearances for Lazio when he's there. I think that this tackle is not a big fork in the road, that if it doesn't happen and he doesn't get injured, everything goes rosily. He spends so much time pranking and away from training. Like, he pisses off the manager, Dino's off so much. Like, you talk about his pranks back in England. The standard in Serie A is so much higher than in England, that while, yes, his footballing skills are brilliant, the level of training and fitness that will be required for him to actually excel in Italy, I'm not sure he ever actually does that. I think Gazza, God, I think he had doomed fate on him from the start, and he would have found another way to bollocks himself up and not excel in this way that you were talking about, Jer. That's my opinion. Tom, what do you think?
I think, like, the thing about him is the move to Lazio is fascinating, because with a guy like him, you know, I think you need to collapse all the variables possible, because he in and of himself is the biggest variable in the world. Like, there's just so many things. And as you said, those self-destructive tendencies are just so littered throughout every single aspect of his life, whether it's the way he trains, it's reckless with the tackles, the way he rests, he doesn't, the way he socializes, it's like, you know, like so like drowned in alcohol. There are so many variables that bringing him to another country just feels like this massive thing. And as well, like, the thing I couldn't get over about Gascoigne is how emotional he is, and what a specific type of like masculinity it is, especially in 90s, you know, 80s and 90s England. Like, just the raw emotion of him. And like there's some really telling quotes like that I read from him in the looking at back at his career, but like the feeling of being loved to him, and the feeling when, like, you know, I don't know, have you seen like the kind of speaking gigs that he does and nearly like theater shows that he does to you know make money now, and when within the first few seconds apparently of every show, I mean, the man can't contain tears. He breaks down and can't speak for like, you know, minutes at a time because he's overwhelmed by the love of these people, like, you know, 20 years after the event. And like, oh, that's kind of like really profound and beautiful and sad all in the one go. But there's clearly like, he is a guy that has a very like thin layer between okay and completely not okay. And I think it's so actually poetic in the fact that the way he does that injury, it's completely his own doing, because it also replicates so much of his career. It kind of all was his own doing.
I know, Dave, you've rebutted me in detail. I'm not saying he's as good as Maradona, but I am just pointing to Maradona goes to Napoli. They're not within an ass's roar and they become the best team. So one player, if they're good enough, can make a huge difference. So the right player in the right team could have closed a gap on that Milan team. We may disagree as to whether that was Gazza and Lazio, but I think it's possible. I also just think we've all talked about the self-destructive tendencies, or we've talked about Tom, that you put it really well, I think, about his emotional state, because it's absolutely right. He's clearly a really emotional guy, which worked for him and against him, I think, at different times. Mm. But I still think the self-destructive tendencies were not around, they were around overexcitement. They were around youth and exuberance misplaced. By the standards of the late 1980s and 1990s, pre-91 Gazza is not a big drinker, like by the standards of the day. So he's not notable for that before this happens. And I think it's very easy for us to go, well, if he was like that in 1997, he must have been the same. It must have been always likely to happen. And he'd got to 24 and it had been okay because he'd had the football in his life. I'm not saying he'd have got to 50 and everything would have been hunky-dory, but he might have got to 30 before the world collapsed in on him and we'd have another 5 or 6 years. I think it's when you take that crutch away, but it does, for me, it doesn't mean it's always inevitable that it would have happened, if not in 91, then in 92 or in 93. It might have been in 99 or 2000 or 2004. I'm not saying it was inevitable forever that it would never happen, but I think he'd have gotten through his 20s.
I don't necessarily fully disagree with you, Jer, but what I do, football was kind of changing in the 90s. I know what you're saying, that kind of pre-1990, he was, the standard of the time, he wasn't a big drinker, but he was still a big drinker because they were all big drinkers. But I think he had addictive tendencies, and I think alcohol was always going to be a problem for him one way or another. But I wonder, kind of aside from that, maybe if he'd been born 10 years earlier and he played at a time when football, because football was getting more professional, it was getting more polished. We've talked about the Premier League kind of before and the Champions League, these brand new products rather than tournaments. And the standard was being raised. Like Ferguson was cleaning out the drinking culture at United. Wenger, you talked about this, Jer, before Wenger came in and got rid of the last of the English drinking culture in Arsenal. And then the rest of the league had to catch up. Gazza was he went to Italy when Italy was already a bit of a step ahead of that. Like the sports science in Italy was massive. Another thing he said was his first training session, he told James Richardson on Football Italia he had more wires in him than a satellite dish. And he just wasn't used to that kind of level of sophistication, which there was in Italy. And I'm not sure he ever would have gotten used to that and really thrived and settled in that, because he didn't have the attitude of a serious trainer, which 10 years earlier, again, maybe wouldn't have been such a big deal. His genius, like Maradona, we've kind of talked about before. I don't think he was ever as good as Maradona, but then nobody was. It's no shame to say that. But he might have been able to have that kind of one person influence that I think was less possible by the time he was actually hitting his peak years. I think even if the injury didn't happen, I'm still not sure he would have had that impact that we're talking about. Again, like he showed at Rangers, he had two seasons there where, again, he was brilliant. Now, the standard of Scottish football wasn't quite as high, but it wasn't as low then as it is now. That was a good Rangers team, and they won a couple of really good titles. So he did show his excellence, but sorry, I'm kind of going off point here. Tom, come in and rescue us from this back and forth argument.
Well, no, that was interesting to me when I was just looking at the cold, hard stats of it. Like, the amount of goals he got in Rangers was more than he got, you know, at Newcastle or at Spurs, particularly Spurs, we would have said he was at, like, you know, in his prime before the injury. So, like, that was interesting to me that even in Rangers, and I'd be interested to hear, like you said, you remember, like, the ghost of that time. But, like, was that more a testament that, like, Scottish football was useless, or was it that, like, this guy still, like, was it a case of him being back in the UK? Like, I just wonder that about, like, the culture of, like, the UK versus you know, versus being in Italy. Like, do you reckon that it was just a case of the league was muck, or that he was just happy to be closer to home?
Probably a combination of the two. I don't think Scottish football definitely wasn't muck then. Like, you'd call it muck now. Then it was a slight level below the Premier League, but not by much. The Premier League hadn't, you know, torn up any trees yet by then. United were the only team doing anything half decent in Europe. So the Scottish Premier League was, like, that was when Rangers, we've talked about this in a couple of previous pods, were spending all that phantom money that would come back and haunt them later on. But it was a good side, and it was a decent league. Like, Celtic had a couple of good players, and Hearts and Aberdeen weren't quite as far away from the Old Firm as they are now. So it was definite glimpses of real quality. But I think you've touched on something very important there, Tom, that we might kind of talk about, is what might have happened. He said himself in a BBC interview years later that he wished he stayed at Spurs, that he was having the time of his life at Spurs, and he wished he'd never gone to Lazio. He wished he'd stayed. And I wonder would staying in England actually have allowed him to thrive a little bit more? I don't know. What do you think about that, Chair?
I don't know. I think, yeah, I mean, the Scottish League, as you said, it was fairly straightforward at Rangers at the time, because while the overall standard of the Scottish League, it wasn't as far behind the Premier League as it is now, Rangers were in the midst of, I think they eventually win 9 in a row in that period. Yeah. For me, I'm going to sound like a broken record on this. I think why he thrives at Rangers again is he actually gets a couple of years of relative fitness. So where he's been a bit stop-starty at Lazio, and he ends up after he leaves Rangers, he actually has a couple of years there where he plays most weeks. Now, whether he needs to be as fit because of the standard Scottish football, but ultimately, I think that's his thing there. I don't know whether being around the goldfish bowl of living in and playing football in Italy, a bit like Spain now, where it's just constant, the dedicated sports media, you didn't get a moment of space. But really, from the summer of 1990 on, Gazza didn't wherever he went. It doesn't take a huge leap for me to go, what he was doing at Rangers, he could have been doing in the Premier League at the same time if he hadn't had those last 3 years.
Yeah, I don't necessarily disagree with that. Yeah. You've mentioned in your grand theory of alternative time that he would possibly end up at United in the middle of the 90s and slot into that midfield. But what about way back when he first signs for Spurs? Ferguson thought he had the deal done, so he pissed off on holidays to Malta. And when he came back, Gazza had signed for Spurs. What if Ferguson had gotten a young Gascoigne under his wing, instead of him going to, you know, geezer boys Spurs?
Yeah, well, there's an incredible quote. Alex Ferguson said, "It would have been different if I had signed for Man United." And in response to this, Gazza says, "Well, Rio Ferdinand did a runner from a fucking drugs test. Eric Cantona two-footed some cunt in the neck in the stand. Wayne Rooney shagged a fucking granny. And Ryan Giggs shagged his brother's fucking wife." Fucking hell, man. And I was just like, that's incredible. And that was his response when, like, that was posed. But, and for all, like, the comedic value of that answer, and it is absolutely hilarious. But, like, I do think that, listening to a really interesting interview with Rio Ferdinand actually just today by pure coincidence, but he was saying about the culture of Man United and the culture of Ferguson's Man United. And when you do hear it within the context of what Ferdinand and he was saying, and he was kind of like how Keane, you know, drove the standards in terms of, like, you know, timekeeping, staying late after training. There was Giggs who'd be, you know, with the yoga practice, with the fitness. There were Scholes who was just driving standards on the pitch every day with this unbelievable consistency. And you do wonder, I think it would have gone one of two ways. It would have been because Ferdinand was saying that if a culture is strong enough, the person becomes the culture. Now, I don't know, Gascoigne is such a force of nature as a person. You wonder, could he be tamed by even the United culture, by even Alex Ferguson? But there is a part of me that wonders, was Ferguson right? Like, Ferguson sent him a letter, and I think he either called him a silly boy or a stupid bastard, depending on what source you listen to. But you do kind of think, like, yeah, he was right. Like, even the way he moved to Spurs, I don't know if you've seen this in the story, but it was like the chairman offered to buy him a house for his folks, and he was like, yeah, that sounds okay. And then he mentioned it to his dad, and his dad was like, what are you waiting for? You have to do it. So he was like, all right. And then his dad rings back a few minutes later. Do you think he might throw in a car? And Gazza rings the chairman, would you throw in a car? He's like, yeah, I'll throw in a car. And then he's driving down the motorway, and the sister's on the phone saying, you know, mom's getting a house, dad's getting a car, I want the sunbed. He ends up with the sunbed, and like, that's how he ends up at Spurs. And once again, it's so on the nose of like how, of course, he ends up at Spurs that way, in this weird non-footballing reason, commercial kind of like looking at the wrong sort of like, yeah, his eye was off the ball. But, you know, you do wonder if he did end up at United, might things have gone very differently for him.
Yeah, it's an interesting one for him. I mean, I also just think he would have been signing for United if we're talking about him signing in 1988. I'm not sure, that culture probably wasn't as embedded yet. Ferguson was in the process of his kind of clear out of you know, he'd got rid of the Whitesides and the McGraths. But, you know, the drinking culture that sort of Brian Robson is central to doesn't really disappear from United for another few years after that. So we wouldn't have been going into the late training and the yoga at that point, really. You know, United at that point probably weren't hugely different to some of the other clubs. Yes.
The chairman, yeah. Yeah, Martin, the chairman. He says, I've got bad news. He's signed for Tottenham. I said, oh, God, oh, man. How could that be? He says, well, apparently that Tottenham have bought his mother and father a house in the northeast, and that swung it. Well, I think it was a bad mistake. And Paul admits it to this day. Because as a 19-year-old lad going to London is not easy.
Yeah, and the other thing about that time is that he does, to be fair, say that Venables is the only one who knew how to manage him. So, like, it would also be this incredible shame if they never got a chance to have that relationship. And I was really struck by, like, yeah, I was really struck by, and I don't know the ins and outs of this, but even just, like, On field, there seemed to be a real bond between him and Lineker. And obviously they had the Spurs days and the England days together. But I did think that was interesting that he said Venables was the only sort of guy who ever fully got him. And I think to a certain extent, even like that famous clip where Lineker, you know, kind of does the face and says, watch him in the World Cup. Like, you do wonder, like, maybe in Spurs he was minded in a way, as you say, it could go one of two ways with Ferguson. But I do wonder, like, because Ferguson and Venables are such different characters.
It's interesting you talk about the relationship with him and Venables, which obviously we saw kind of flower briefly again for England in Euro 96 when he was quite excellent. It kind of keeps bringing me back to this, and I'm not a person at all who believes in fate or superstition, but even like Venables kind of moved on as Spurs manager very quickly after Gazza left. So even if Gazza does stay at Spurs, he probably still doesn't have that relationship that he had with Venables. The poor fucker seemed to be damned whatever he went, whatever he did. There was a dark sign across him or something.
Yeah, I do think that's something that we should probably rule out in terms of, you know, no matter how he comes to the cup final, he's gone. So him staying at Spurs is not even and with Venables isn't even an option. You know, he's a pawn in a financial game at the time, and that Spurs need money and they flog him. Which may fit in with that dark sign theory.
Let's not call it a theory. I'm not going to go that far. But look, now let's get into that, lads, because that's really interesting what you brought up there, Jer, is you said like there was no way he was staying at Spurs, because Spurs were this is the year before, the season before the Premier League starts, or the two seasons before the Premier League starts. You've got the next year where Leeds win the league, and then the Premier League comes in with all its glitz and glam and dancers at Crystal Palace and money and all that. But Spurs are fucking broke.
Yeah,
they have to sell him. So yeah. The fee that Lazio originally agree with Spurs in 1991, when he's due to go after the cup final, is £8.8 million, I think. Now, they end up getting quite a bit less. Now, they do stay in and they do want to buy him, but they get him a year later. And obviously, like we've talked about, they get a completely different player, but they only spend 5.5 something million on him. Yeah. Jerry, you've talked about this before, so I'm going to throw it to you here. And then you lads are two Spurs fans, but Jerry, even that extra year that Spurs had to keep him and had to,
yeah,
just talk us through that.
Yeah, I mean, ultimately they have to sell him because it's not an amount that sounds big now when, you know, goalkeepers are moving for 70 million, but Spurs were 10 million in debt, which was major financial crisis pre-Premier League. And they brought in all sorts of accountants to see how can we balance the books here. He's the only real prize asset we have. Let's sell him. So had he gone in 1991, the bulk of the money would probably have still gone into the black hole. But instead, as you said, they have to keep him for a year, keep paying him, pay for his treatment, and then they get 3 million less. Obviously, you wouldn't have foreseen that in 91, but had he gone, there's the possibility that Spurs could have gone out and spent 1 or 2 million of that, replacing him with somebody who, you know, for 2 million quid in 1991, you'd have got a pretty good player. That obviously they don't end up having that. They have this hiatus year and then he goes and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, Spurs have gone from, since Gazza had come in and then Lineker had come in, as I said, they got to third in the league. They'd fallen back, but had won the FA Cup. But they were very much in that place that they sort of got back to only in the last less than a decade, where they're sort of, you know, not realistic title contenders, but in that sort of third to seventh kind of bracket, with a good run, they could get second. But, you know, they were in that big five of English football just before the Premier League starts. That's the group that they're in. And then they lose the one player that's at the heart of that, and they aren't able to replace him. And then the 90s becomes keep the doors open and the lights on financially. You know, Sugar and Venables have to come in and save the club from extinction. They've all sorts of managers come in. They should have been relegated because of financial irregularities. That was relegated and it was overturned. The 90s is just a period of chaos that really Spurs get back to where they would have been in 1991, in 2009 or 10, Harry Redknapp sort of era. But had they been able to cash in on some of the money, you know, take the 8 million, put 6 of it against the debt, go out and spend 2 million on a decent young player, Spurs could have, in the last season before the Premier League, finished in the top 6. And in the first season of the Premier League, finished in the top 6. And actually, then the financial worries could have started to go away as the money starts flowing in from the Premier League. And instead of a 90s where Spurs are battling relegation and a 2000s where they're that sort of non-entity that Tom talked about, you could have had a 90s where Spurs are in that sort of jockeying to get into Europe position and then build on that in the 2000s. And there's a lost 20 years because of it, I think. Now, whether that money would have been reinvested wisely is a separate question, but that's the potential impact on Spurs as I see it.
Lost 20 years, Tom, what do you think?
Yeah, well, but it's interesting because you frame it as the last 20 years, and I was thinking of it, and it's more of a question, but was that the beginning of the reputation Spurs had for certainly my lifetime as a selling club? And like, and again, it would match to certainly 15 years because you're looking at Michael Carrick goes for big money, Berbatov goes for big money, Modric goes for big money, Bale goes for big money. And, you know, it's interesting because we're now at a juncture in completely up-to-date modern Spurs times where Harry Kane is the one that everyone's talking about now.
Yeah.
And in a post-COVID transfer market, what does that look like? But, you know, I couldn't see him moving anywhere for anything less than probably 130 plus million. I just don't think Levy will let it happen. But also, it'll be really interesting to see because that's the other big change in Spurs from the Gazza era to now, because now Spurs are this really, like, really impressively run club, certainly from a financial point of view. Like, they're the 10th richest club in the world, which is kind of bananas when you think about it, insofar as, like, they don't win anything, you know? Like, yeah. It's kind of insane that they are at this level. But, like, Gascoigne was that first big, big, big money transfer. And like, it probably did take them 20 years to really say, like, if we want to go to that next level and become not just a rich club, but become a club who can, everyone talks about like Spurs' illustrious history, but it is an old history. You know what I mean? Like, there is very little in modern times. And yeah, they're at that juncture again where they kind of have to decide, like, where do we go now?
Absolutely. That's a good point, actually. I probably haven't thought about the fact that, you know, Gazza is the one who triggers the selling club reputation. Because, as I said, in the 80s, Spurs were one of the big five. So they were the ones who were picking up. And there wasn't the Liverpool dominance was there, and Everton to an extent as well. But they were the ones picking off the players from the other clubs. And obviously money wasn't to quite the same extent. But, you know, Bill Nicholson, even then, back in the 60s, would go out and he'd bring Jimmy Greaves in. Or, they were spending money. And then they get into that financial hole and they sell Gazza. And then you're right. Yeah, I mean, all the players you mentioned. But even before that, there's like, you know, Sheringham goes to United. And some of it is about they're going for success at clubs who will deliver medals. And I think that's what Kane's going to be about more than any financial thing. But it probably does start then about balancing the books with selling players. And then now, as you say, with Levy and it's a well-run business, it's about cashing in on assets for that reason. But like in terms of the lost era, I think it's more just to do with the fact of, you look at Spurs league finishes in the last couple of decades of the 80s and the early 90s, and it's where they got back to under Pochettino, which we're raving about. And I would say Pochettino is the best Spurs manager since Bill Nicholson. Without a shadow of a doubt. But we sort of only got back to where we could have been 30 years ago, in a way.
Are we saying that basically this the financial implications of Gazza's injury potentially, obviously we can't look through an actual crystal ball, but potentially prevent Spurs from almost taking Arsenal's place or being at a level of Arsenal during those 90s and then building on it from there?
I think that's probably too simplistic, because I do think it's incumbent on that they would have had any of the 8.5 million to reinvest, firstly, because of the debt issue. And secondly, if they had invested it wisely to keep that going, that would have been incumbent on. It's a possibility. Arsenal were ahead of them. I mean, Arsenal won the league that year as well. So Arsenal were that little bit ahead already. But I certainly think they wouldn't have necessarily been a club in the 90s who spent hovering around 13th and 14th. It could have been 6th and 7th.
Yeah, and I can't see, like, the time and the faith that was put into Arsene Wenger, just from what I know about that time. Like, and I think that the Spurs crowd, like that White Hart Lane crowd, it's quite a volatile crowd. And like, if they don't like what they see, I mean, volatile is not the right word. You know, we're not talking about Millwall, but they're vocal. Yeah. And if they don't like the style of football, they boo, you know, or like, they certainly, like, there will be dissent. And that is the one thing that drives, like, you know, chairman I think in any era of football, but certainly if there is that, you know, booing in the stadium, like, that's how managers go. And I'm not sure that there would have been someone that could have, like, appeased the Spurs crowd long enough. And I'm not sure that the board during that time would have had the resolve to resist that chopping and changing, because like, there were just an awful lot of mediocre managers, like, flung in and flung out. And, you know, that that was the time with the Fergusons and the Wengers. And that probably time is gone. But I can't see Spurs, like, nearly having the sense to have stuck with something like that.
No, absolutely not. But it's also why, I mean, that sort of thing about the fans and the fans' reaction, it's why the Gazzas of this world are so popular, because they're the players who do get the fans off their feet. Now, if you can be so lucky as well as he was for those couple of years at Spurs and in England in particular, that you also deliver results and you drive your team forward. But fans just love seeing that sort of entertainment as well. And it's just another reason why someone like that, and just to bring it back to him again, why he's so valued.
Look, one more like, quick question I want to ask, lads, is, let's say, Jer, let's say your scenario plays out. He goes to Italy, fully fit, top of his game. He adapts, he gets himself stuck in. He's a revelation at Lazio. He leads them to what a success, maybe a Scudetto, maybe even a European Cup or Champions League. And he comes back to England in the mid-90s as an absolute global superstar. Like, he's one of the best players in the world, if not the best player in the world. And he comes back and plays in England at a time when English football is still a little kind of trudging along. Wenger hasn't come along yet. Ferguson hasn't really developed the excellent teams of later years. They're still struggling in Europe. What happened? What would that mean for the Premier League? Paul Gascoigne, world superstar, comes around the same time as Dennis Bergkamp. We're probably talking around the same time. What would that do?
David Platt is probably the comparable who actually comes in that period as the English player playing abroad. You know, if we have the Gaza that I would like to think could have been, it is a whole different level. It's something that wouldn't have existed. I don't think there's a frame of reference for what it could have looked like, because the only sort of the only other English footballer who was probably that stratospherically famous was probably Beckham, who went abroad at that time. So the idea of that potentially the best player in the world could be English and playing abroad probably isn't something that we have a reference for. This is how it plays out. I don't know. I mean, it probably would have been the natural place for him to come. But as you said, the likes of Bergkamp was starting to come. Klinsmann had come to Spurs just after the World Cup. We were getting to that phase where we were starting to move beyond in the Premier League, just starting to, the sort of over-the-hill foreigners coming at the tail end of their career, and some of them were starting to come in their prime. Yeah, I mean, it would have been a big coup for a Premier League club to have brought the golden boy of English football home. But I think, yeah, the Premier League was becoming a brilliant product around that time anyway.
Because we've always had, like, you've a few examples like Bergkamp and maybe like Patrick Vieira and someone like that coming to the Premier League. But realistically, even still in throughout our lifetimes, first of all the best players in the world went to Italy, then they went to Spain, and now they only go to Barcelona or Real Madrid, but obviously they're kind of broke now. But to have the best, possibly the best player in the world coming to England then in the 90s could have set an amazing precedent and could have seen even more of a, if again, it wasn't just really good foreign players coming, but actually the best of the best coming to the Premier League.
Yeah, and it would have been interesting, like, you know, where would he have gone? Because, yeah, there isn't loads of templates for it, as Jared said. And, like, you know, the fantasy I think you always have, even, you know, and I don't mean to keep bringing it back to modern Tottenham, but it is my reference point. But even if, like, when Gareth Bale went, for example, there always was that thing of he'll come back. And, you know, even if Harry Kane does go, and there is, like, I 100% would be like, oh, he'll come back. You know, he'll go and he'll win a Champions League. He'll win, you know, a Premiership medal in City or United or wherever he does it, but he'll come back. And, like, it would have been this amazing thing if Gaza went back to Spurs, because I think for a guy like Gaza, I think the thing was the love. Like, it was the love that, and he says it in there's a brilliant piece in The Athletic, and they go to one of his live shows and he breaks down at the start of the live show, as he does every live show. And it's not like a rehearsed bit, like he really can't handle the applause as he walks into a room. Like, he's not able for the love of it. And I really think that if he were to come back to Spurs and to get that love from those fans, you know, English fans, but Spurs fans, and he brought so much joy to them before. Like, I think that, you know, I think he's a guy that, like, operated from that place of, like, to be honest, you know, and it is so tempting to do the pop psychology, but, like, I don't think deep down he felt worthy of the love that all these millions of people, you know, gave to him after the World Cup, after, like, the heroics, after the passion, all of this. I don't think he ever felt deserving of that. And I think that that's why he was such a raw wound, because they loved him so much more than he loved himself. He couldn't handle it. And, like, you know, it was, I think that, you know, as you said, Jared, like, the if the drinking did change, like, I think it was to cope with this just massive, like, disconnect between, you know, on some level how he saw himself, on the other level how the rest of the world saw him.
I think that's a really good point, but I actually think he kind of trades, his football trades off that love. I think when, you know, he mightn't feel worthy of it, but on the field, when he's loved and gets that Venables arm around him or whatever it might be, that's when he plays really well. And actually, he comes back from Italia 90 and now has all of this pressure and this adulation. And he's brilliant that season. It's the best season he probably has at Spurs. Like, you look at the FA Cup record. I mean, I did have to look it up, but I nearly knew it off by heart. He sets up the goal in the first round and he scores in every other round to the final. He single-handedly drags them through. And this is with all of this pressure. So he could take it when he was in a happy place, or in so much of a happy place as he could be. talking about homecomings, there's another tantalizing possibility, possibly not in 95-96, but if he holds off a year or two, the club who are ahead of Spurs at that time, what if he comes to Keegan's Newcastle?
Oh, wow. Mm. And you've Beardsley there as well, actually, of course. And
definitely would, you know, he'd get the arm around the shoulder then and the love and back home again. You know, again, that's probably clinging on trying to stay on till probably 96, 97-ish, which is, you know, a long time to have stayed in at Lazio for. And he probably wouldn't have done that. But there is something, as you said, tantalizingly tempting about considering a nice romantic homecoming that works out. I don't think it would have been Spurs. I think if we're talking about a Gazza who's coming back to the Premier League in the peak of his powers in 95, he's too big for Spurs, unfortunately. Mm-hmm.
Supporting what you said there, Ger, there's a good article I read in The Set Pieces by Alex Hess called Paul Gascoigne's Career Stalling Setback Against Nottingham Forest. And he kind of sums it up quite well at the end. He said, is it too simplistic to see that one tackle as having sent an English icon on the booze-soaked path to self-destruction? Quite possibly. But there's no doubt whatsoever that his career and possibly his life would have played out completely differently without it. Certainly, Gazza doesn't need telling. I wish I'd got sent off for that first tackle on Parker, he admitted some years later. Don't we all?
Yeah, that's it. It's the and he should have been sent off for that tackle, by the way.
he should have been arrested.
Oh, it's unbelievable. It's like the Undertaker, you know, the WWE wrestler. And he used to have the big boot and he was like, you know, 6'4", and he'd get it up as far as his head and the other person would run into it. Like, it was that kind of style of a kick. It was unbelievable. And yeah, in that same spirit, Dave, like the Athletic article that I read during the week, it's by Daniel Taylor, and there's a lovely quote that actually opens the article, but I do think it kind of like, it sums up Gazza so well, and it sums him up then and now. And the quote is, I miss football badly. It was my life. I miss every game. I miss every Saturday. Come 3 o'clock now, I switch off. 3 o'clock to 4:45, that was my life. I loved it so much. When I had you all in front of me, I got a buzz. On a Sunday morning, I still had a buzz thinking of you. And when I go get up tomorrow morning, I'll be in tears because I miss you. And Paul Gascoigne appears to be crying as he delivers this. And you're like, wow. Like, that sums up so much of him, because it sums up the joy of him. It sums up the raw emotion of him. And it does sum up the fact that the football pitch was the only place where he truly was at home, at peace, and, you know, in the place where he was meant to be. Like, it was described as, like, in the 90 minutes of a match, you know, he was relaxed, and for the, you know, 22 and a half hours for the rest of the day, he wasn't. And there's such a tragedy in that, because, like, I think about this all the time, you know, if you are a professional footballer, like, by the time you're 33, like, you're so close to the end of, like, the thing, the only thing you know how to do, and, like, the thing that, you know, has provided all your, like, value and, like, meaning and so much. Like, that is such an existentially massive thing to be grappling with. And, like, the fact that this man now in his, you know, mid-50s is still in the grips of that kind of identity crisis, like, it's profound.
You know, sometimes I do look back and I think, what would have been if, you know, would have won the amount of stuff that Rios won at Man United, or all the players that went there, and, you know, because at that time when I signed with Spurs, Man United weren't winning everything, you know, and when I did sign with Spurs, that's when Man United become great, all the young kids coming through, Rio joined them, and they're winning everything, weren't they? And you think, only if, you know, I wonder if so. You know, sometimes you have to look at that, and it's probably one of the regrets I had, but I did have the opportunity to work with some great guys, yeah, and with a great manager, it was Terry Venables, you know.
Thank you so much for tuning in. We hope you enjoyed this episode of Outside the Box. If you think things would have played out very differently, or especially if you think we nailed it here, we'd love to hear from you.
Or if you have any ideas for other interesting what-ifs, you can get in touch with us on Twitter or Instagram at WhatIfFootyPod, or by email at outsidetheboxwhatif@gmail.com. We hope you tune in again next week, and please tell your friends if you liked the show, and even if you didn't, tell them you did. I've been Dave Fleming.
And I've been Jared O'Shea. And this has been Outside the Box.
A bit of a fairy tale, really.
Happy, so happy. Couldn't sleep last night. I had to have a couple of injections because I was just doing. I'd have a couple of injections because I couldn't sleep. So nervous. I'm happy. I'm now away to get my shoot measured. Yes!
What about your start to the game?
It wasn't bad, was it? Missed it.